Thanks for joining us. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, a columnist for the Boston Globe, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Leaders of two dozen NATO countries meet in Warsaw to strengthen the military alliance after Britain's vote to leave the European Union. President Obama announces he will keep 8,400 troops in Afghanistan. A 2.6-million-word British inquiry excoriates former British Prime Minister Tony Blair for the UK's involvement in the Iraq War, and a woman is set to lead the UK for the first time since Margaret Thatcher. Joining me for the International Hour of this week's News Roundup, Christian Carl with Foreign Policy, Nadia Bilbasi of Al Arabiya, and Jeff Dyer with the Financial Times. Welcome to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. And as always, we want to hear from all of you, our listeners. So you can call us anytime with your comments and your questions throughout the hour, 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email to @drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or send us a tweet to @drshow. So let's start out, guys, with talking about NATO. Leaders of the military alliance are meeting in Poland at a time of tensions with Russia, terrorist attacks worldwide, and a migrant crisis caused by the war in Syria. Tell us, Christian, why is this summit being called the most significant one since the end of the Cold War?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think there are several reasons. First of all, there is, of course, most immediately the Brexit vote, which has completely jolted the alliance. I think many people in Washington and probably in a lot of other European NATO capitals were not prepared for this at all. The second thing is, of course, the Islamic State, the threat from ISIS, which has shown itself so dramatically over the past few weeks. And the third thing is the relationship with Russia, which is becoming increasingly fraught. Russia has attacked its neighbors three times over the past few years. That is a serious threat, a serious issue. It has put NATO back at the forefront of the agenda, but it's done so at a time when NATO is arguably weaker than it's ever been before because of the forces that are pulling very hard at the internal cohesion of the European Union.
All right. Well, Nadia, tell us, what are the leaders actually hoping to accomplish? The summit's only 2 days long for the leaders. What are they going to be able to get done about ISIS or Russia or anything else?
Well, so ironically, this summit is the last for President Obama, and it's happening in Warsaw, in Poland, which joined NATO in 1999, and they were really hoping that's going to be really a big summit for them because they wanted to show that they are very worried about Russia, basically, and they wanted to show that NATO is there to protect them. And there has been talk about that in this summit, actually, that NATO countries, member states, which is, I think, is attended by 28 European unions and 26 from worldwide, that they will be able to put battalions on the border and in Baltic states like Estonia and Moldova, etc. But some people say that the Russians will laugh at that because the maximum they can be able to put is around four battalions of like 800 to 1,000 troops, while they need much more than that. The estimate is like probably five to seven and much stronger. But, the whole essence of NATO is always with Russia, in particular regarding Poland, is always been dealing with it from the perspective of strength and negotiation. Now, in this summit, it comes really at the worst time, even for President Obama, that's been distracted domestically by what happened in Dallas, and he's been informed, and he's been making statements instead of just focusing on the bigger threat, as Christian just alluded to, which is ISIS. Can they really get their forces together? Can they train Iraqi troops, as we have seen these atrocities that hit Karada in center of Baghdad and killed almost 300 people? Are they able to maintain this idea that ISIS is no longer wanted just to be content with the state in Iraq and Syria, but they wanted to show their ability and their potent in striking from Turkey to Bangladesh to elsewhere? Are they able to do all of that? We will see. And I think that the elephant in the room is the Brexit and the leave of the decision of Britain to leave the European Union. And will this impact NATO or not? I think that will be on top of the agenda.
All right. Well, before the Brexit vote, before the latest ISIS-related aided, enabled, or ISIS-inspired attacks over the last week that have killed more than 300 people. The main thing on the agenda was supposed to be the military alliance of 28 nations convincing Russia that NATO means business. And as Nadia says, part of the importance is that it's in Poland, right on the edge there of Russia. So, Jeff, tell us, how is Russia going to respond to a stronger NATO presence in the Baltic states? What are possible scenarios?
Well, that's the key question. I mean, it's possible that this will act as a deterrent to Russia, that Russia will take note of this and realize that NATO is very serious about defending and territorial integrity of its members, including the Baltic states. But it's also entirely possible that Russians will see this as a provocation and that they will seek to increase their military presence along their own western border. And particularly, what a lot of NATO officials are worried about is the area called Kaliningrad, which is this little thin sliver of territory separate from the rest of Russia, but between Poland and Lithuania, where there has been a military build-up going on, and the word that Russia will seek to build up even more the military presence there, heightening even more the tensions between key NATO members and the Russians.
All right. Well, we, of course, have to remind listeners, especially some of our younger listeners, that those Baltic states used to be part of the Soviet Union. And so this is all, you know, stuff that has changed in the last 25 years. But, Christian, I want to ask you, you know, not every nation within the 28-member alliance is completely comfortable with taking a tougher position towards Russia, even though we're 2 years since Russia seized Crimea and has been destabilizing the whole part of Ukraine on its border. Tell us more.
Yes, well, that's a very important point. There are a whole range of different things going on. I'm not sure we can get into all of them. But let's just take, for example, Turkey, which is a country people rarely think about in the context of NATO. It's one of the biggest NATO members and has one of the biggest military forces. They have just embarked on a diplomatic rapprochement with Russia, right? President Erdogan has just decided to get over a bad patch in his relations with Russia after Turkey shot down a Russian fighter plane that crossed the border. Now they're trying to mend fences again. So I wonder very much what the Turkish position at the summit will be. Then you have people like Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who has said that he's a great admirer of Putin and wants closer relations with Russia. And then you have a whole host of other factors, such as the rise of these new right-wing populists, some of them not so new, like Frances Marie Le Pen, who've also expressed great admiration for Putin and seem to cast a lot of doubt on the need for NATO today. So there are a lot of question marks there.
Well, you know, also there's the whole question of Italy and some of the other southern NATO states who were concerned about the sanctions against Russia over Ukraine a couple years ago and were pushing against that all along. Jeff, I want to ask you, as someone from the other side of the Atlantic, what about the concerns that NATO has about Britain's exit from the European Union? How much is that going to affect this conversation at the summit?
Well, it's going to be in the background of every conversation, but it's going to be something that's going to take a long time to play out. I mean, if Brexit is a key moment that accelerates the unraveling of the European Union and accelerates the growth of these nationalist forces, particularly some of those pro-right nationalist forces that are more sympathetic towards Putin and Russia, then absolutely that would be the start of something that would be very, very damaging to NATO. But it's not at all inevitable that is the way it's going to play out. And you could, for instance, imagine a situation where a British government that leaves the EU actually tries to increase its presence in NATO, increase its military spending, because that's one of the other ways it can seem relevant, can punch above its weight, as Britain likes to say, in international affairs. So there's a clear risk to the Western alliance. There's a clear risk to NATO from Brexit. But none of this is inevitable. None of it's preordained.
And specifically, what did President Obama say today about Britain's vote to leave the EU? He was trying to calm concerns at NATO, right?
He was trying to make precisely that point that, you know, nothing's inevitable here. Don't think that just because Britain has done this that somehow, you know, the tide of nationalism is going to be unleashed again and we're back to the 1930s in Europe. That was the message he was trying to give across. But that's obviously the thing that we're going to be watching over the next few years as this plays out.
Nadia, tell us about the ISIS aspect here, the terrorism, because that's also something very much on the minds of Turkey in particular, one of the key NATO members, but also the U.S. and all of Europe.
Absolutely. And I think this kind of complicated relationship between Turkey and the United States and other European countries, precisely because there is accusation and some evidence to support that Turkey has allowed thousands of fighters to cross the border between Turkey and Syria. And many people, as they said, when you go to Istanbul airport and you see these people taking domestic flights to Gaziantep and Antakya, which is the southern cities in Turkey, that everybody knows that they call them the Jihadi Express or spot the jihadis. Basically, they know they were going to Syria. And there was a miscalculation because I think President Erdogan was thinking that he wanted to get Assad out. And the only potent force to fight him was these jihadis. And he thought he can control them. But obviously, what we have seen in Ataturk airport attack last week, that he could not. And these are monsters that you cannot deal with and you cannot cooperate with, you cannot close an eye upon. So hence, I think Turkey now has come into a different policy from, as just Christian just mentioned as well, in terms of Russia, that all this tension with Russia, now they wanted to force some kind of alliance. And there is talks, although the White House has denied it, that there is a plan that the president was considering whereby he and Russia will cooperate in hitting Jabhat al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, and ISIS in return for keeping the moderate opposition in Syria.
And so there might be actually something in practice terms that NATO members can do against Islamic terrorists that could be discussed this week.
Oh, sure. For sure, I think they can discuss how, and also training in both of Iraqi troops in Iraq and in Jordan as well. It's very vital to fight ISIS.
All right. We are going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to start going to your calls and your questions. We'll be talking more about this week's international headlines. Stay with us.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Joining me in the studio today to talk about this week's international headlines, Christian Carl, a senior fellow with the Legatum Institute, a contributing editor with Foreign Policy magazine, and author of Strange Rebels, 1979 and the Birth of the 21st Century, Nadia Bilbasi, Washington bureau chief of Al Arabiya Television, Jeff Dyer, a foreign policy correspondent with the Financial Times and author of The Contest of the Century, The New Era of Competition with China and How America Can Win. Christian, the 1979 word in the title of your book makes me think, of course, of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which was the very beginning of a long story that now brings us to this week with President Obama making the announcement that he is going to slow down the pace of withdrawing U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Of course, withdrawing U.S. troops from Afghanistan and Iraq was a big pillar of his campaign 8 years ago. So tell us what happened this week.
Well, President Obama announced that he was actually not going to draw down U.S. forces in Afghanistan to the level that people had originally anticipated. When he came into office, there were 40,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Today, there are still 10,000. And he had put out the idea that that number might decline to something in the area of 5,000. And now he said, actually, no, we're going to withdraw maybe 1,500 troops at the most, but the level is going to remain pretty much in the same ballpark. And the reason for that is that despite the billions of dollars NATO has poured into Afghanistan over the past few years, despite years and years of effort, the Afghan security forces, the security forces of the government of Afghanistan that we recognize, still have not really been able to cope with the Taliban threat. The Taliban control today about a fifth of the country. and an end to that war is not in sight. So President Obama basically showed some flexibility by acknowledging that doesn't look like there's going to be a situation anytime soon where we can just pull out all the U.S. troops.
Let me ask you, what difference on the ground is it going to make between having 8,400 U.S. troops versus 5,500 U.S. troops in Afghanistan?
Well, I guess the president took the decision upon an advice from the general, especially General Nicholson, who thought that they should keep that number. And I think Senator Graham as well, he said a very important kind of statement saying that if you withdraw now, even if the number, as you just said, 8,400, you will have another Iraq. And the difference here is while the Iraqi parliament and the Iraqi prime minister at the time said, I don't want American troops to stay in Iraq, this Afghan government wants the American troops and NATO to stay there. So for him, it's an investment. This is the longest war America had. And to withdraw now, it's basically guaranteed.
Has ever had. It's longer than Vietnam, well,
it's true.
Even.
It's true. He's going to guarantee complete chaos. I mean, there is no peace process. We don't know anything anymore about this. The new Taliban leader who wanted to get into negotiation that started somehow in Qatar a long time ago, and now it's ended. So you don't have a diplomatic initiatives. You don't have security forces that's able to protect the country with hundreds of dead, mainly police officers, cadets in Kabul. And not a long time ago that Taliban were able to hold the city of Kunduz, the big city of Kunduz, even if it's for a short period. It shows they are very potent forces, and therefore the president, although, as you said, I'm sure he's relying on some kind of intelligence and of some kind of military advice why this number, but it cannot be reduced just to 5,500 because the country is big. You need just not to train and to share intelligence, but you need sometimes to relax or to relax these rules to allow them to engage at some point.
Jeff, let me ask you, to what extent is this partly about sending a message to the Afghan government and of support and to the Taliban enemies? How much of it is about messaging and symbolism as opposed to tactical calculations about a few thousand troops?
I think that's definitely part of it. It's a way of saying to the Afghan government, we're still supporting you and we're going to be here with you and we're going to support your military and we're going to keep up this training operation. We're not leaving anytime soon. But I think that, the thing, so with my colleagues been saying, that's hanging over this is the specter of the withdrawal from Iraq. Whether there was an option or not for the U.S. to actually stay in Iraq or not, just the idea that when the U.S. pulled out in 2011 and that helped facilitate the rise of sectarian violence, the rise of a new civil war, that is the reality that's hanging over this administration. It's going to hang over the next administration. Whether the next president wants to try and get out of Afghanistan or not, it's going to face that dilemma right from the start of his or her administration.
We have an email from a listener, Barbara, who says, in all of the reporting I've seen and heard about troops in Afghanistan, I've seen nothing about the wishes of the Afghan government. Did President Ashraf Ghani request the extension? Does anyone know?
Well, I think, as Nadia just said, this is a very different situation from Iraq, where the Iraqi government at the time said they didn't want U.S. troops in any significant numbers in the country anymore. President Ashraf Ghani has said very explicitly, I may be mistaken, but I believe also with parliamentary support, that they want U.S. troops to stay in the country. And I think the announcement, as Jeff was saying, the announcement that President Obama made had a very clear political point in that he was renewing the American promise of assistance to that government and saying, we're not leaving anytime soon.
And for the Afghan government, it's not just about the U.S. presence of the U.S. military and the NATO military force. They worry that if the military leaves, then the political will to keep giving the economic aid, which their government completely relies on, will start to disappear. So
yes.
It's both things.
Good
for the
point.
Afghan government.
It's about sending a message that the war is not over and getting money for humanitarian and economic projects as well.
The White House also said that the President Obama will meet with President Ghani in the summit today or tomorrow,
at
the NATO summit to give it more importance. One last point
I
would add.
Of course, Ashraf Ghani is there because even though Afghanistan is not a member of NATO, they have NATO forces in their country.
One last point I will add is the danger of ISIS and Al-Qaeda regrouping in Afghanistan. If you think that we are done with, I think we are wrong, and this is why the president decided to keep these troops. As we have seen, the attack in Bangladesh is very close in Southeast Asia, and also Al-Qaeda there. And as we force ISIS to leave Iraq and Syria with more airstrike and taking land from them, they have to go back. back to the old home if you want, and Taliban is there to welcome them, it's very easy for them to restructure and to get together, whether it's Al-Qaeda or even the new rising threat of ISIS.
Good point to remind listeners that one of the original havens for international Islamic violent extremists was actually Afghanistan.
Absolutely.
Prior to the 9/11 attacks. We now think about so many other countries being havens, but that was an original haven. All right, well, Christian, I want to ask you, given President Obama's promise 8 years ago on the campaign trail that he was going to take U.S. troops out of Middle Eastern wars and end U.S. involvement in Afghanistan as well as Iraq, I'm also thinking of the Jeffrey Goldberg article with all those interviews he compiled in Atlantic, where the president seemed to suggest that he felt a little bit pushed into doing that troop surge in 2009 and adding 30,000 extra troops to Afghanistan. So how difficult do you think it was for the president to come to this decision to slow down the withdrawal?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think your reference to the Jeffrey Goldberg article is very relevant because President Obama made it very clear in that article that he does sometimes feel pressured by what he called the foreign policy establishment to take certain decisions. On the other hand, I think it's important to remember that when he came into office, the Democrats mostly held the position that the Iraq war was the bad war, the war that we could have avoided, that Afghanistan was the good war, right? The legitimate war, precisely because al-Qaeda had been based there. So I think perhaps he feels a bit more flexibility in this case than he might have felt on the Iraq war. I mean, remember, he denounced the Iraq war long before he became president. I don't recall him coming out quite that negatively against the Afghanistan war. So I don't think his stake here is quite as profound.
And the other interesting thing is just how ambiguous public opinion is towards Afghanistan. I mean, the politics around the Iraq war are still ferocious on both sides. But there's no strong body of public opinion pushing the president to pull out of Afghanistan, nor there is a hugely strong body of public opinion pushing him to stay. It's a rather ambivalent position the American public has towards the country's longest ever war.
Nadia, we were talking a minute ago about Islamic terrorism around the world. There was yet another suicide bombing in Iraq, this one at a Shia shrine in Balad late yesterday. Tell us quickly, what do we know so far?
Well, this is a typical modus operandi of ISIS. Basically, they go for the Shia shrines. They took the Shia centers because they consider them the enemy. And we have seen even the biggest strike they have done last week in Karada, as I mentioned, and it was striking Shiites and to a larger extent Christians as well. And it's a message for them that we are able to strike in the heart of Baghdad, and the security apparatus that works for President Abadi is not working at all.
I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. You know, it's striking to me that this striking of the shrine has followed a horrific bombing in Baghdad over the weekend that also targeted an area where there were largely Shiites. We know almost 300 people dead from that attack alone. I'm wondering, what do these back-to-back attacks mean for the stability of the Iraqi government, for Prime Minister al-Abadi?
Well, I think there's a very important element that often gets lost in the reporting, which is that the people who run Islamic State are not stupid. They know that the only way they can really be conclusively be beaten is politically, not just on the battlefield, but politically. Prime Minister Abadi, if he wants to really beat ISIS, he has to show Sunnis in Iraq that he's willing to reconcile with them, that he's willing to bring them back into the political fold. And attacks like these are designed explicitly by targeting Shia, by targeting his own constituency, are intended to drive a wedge between Sunni and Shia and to limit the prime minister's ability to make that kind of deal. So basically, these terrorist attacks are targeting the possibility of political reconciliation in Iraq by deepening the sectarian divide. That's the fundamental thing here.
Because he has been trying to decentralize power, allow regional governors, for example, to you know, in Anbar, to have more control.
Was a successful example, but also as they lose territory in Fallujah especially. And there was a debate about the Hashd al-Shaabi, which is a popular Shiite forces, that they will enter Sunni towns. And they were saying that we actually going to allow people from Sunnis to run it, and mayors and whatever. But I wanted to come back to a very important point as well regarding this attack. It wasn't just, as Christian just said, that absolutely they are very, they know exactly what ISIS want, and they can exploit the political division. But there is a huge security gap here. The fact that they were able to drive this huge truck to a shopping center and kill 300 people, and guess what? These metal detectors, apparently, that they have enforced in the around Baghdad, they didn't work. And the biggest scandal of all, that they were sold during Prime Minister Maliki by a British businessman, to Jeff, I have to turn left, and the Iraqis paid $40 million for it. And you know what they were used? They were fake metal detectors that they were used to find golf balls lost on the track.
Oh, my goodness.
Can you believe it? And basically, people were criticizing the Prime Minister Maliki before and Abadi, and now it shows it's just there is corruption inside the security forces to the degree that the Interior Minister has to resign, and today Abadi has sacked three or four of senior security officers.
Yes, of course. One of the points of these attacks is always to show your government can't protect you.
Right.
Jeff, quickly, I mean, this, we're talking about Iraq, but this is one of a spate of attacks by extremists that have punctuated in the last week the end of the holiest month of the Islamic calendar. We've seen them in Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Bangladesh, Turkey. Why have the Islamic radicals chosen Ramadan, and why target Muslim nations?
The Ramadan thing has been something that happened last year and again this year. There was a message sent out by Abu Muhammad al-Adani, the spokesman of ISIS, who said at the start of Ramadan, we want to have a month of calamity, giving this message to people around, to ISIS supporters around the world, to conduct these attacks. But what they're trying to show through this is they have this phenomenal international reach. You know, the attacks from Bangladesh and Turkey, we've seen incidents in France as well. It's really all over the world that they're trying to show that, you know, even if you take some of our territory in Iraq and in Syria, we are able to get back at you anywhere around the world that you want.
I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join in our conversation, you can call us anytime at 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also find us on Facebook or on Twitter. Nadia, I want to follow up with what Jeff said, because Obviously we know from the U.S. military reports, the coalition military reports, that ISIS has lost 50% of the land it was holding in Iraq, 20% of the land it was holding in Syria. So is ISIS simply lashing out because they're losing?
Yes. I mean, this is what John Brennan said, the director of the CIA. And if you talk to the intelligence Miller, they will tell you that in the old days that Al-Qaeda is more dangerous than ISIS for one reason. Al-Qaeda always targeted Western targets. They wanted to kill Americans, Europeans, all over the world, while ISIS was content of having so-called a state of their own and inviting people to come and join them. Now they lose in this state. So basically they wanted to show they are a formidable force. And this is a recruiting tool for them to show that they can strike anywhere. What's bizarre about the latest attacks, not just in Bangladesh, to show that they are able to hold hostages and to kill people, and in Turkey, which is a soft target, by the way. I think all of us has been in and out of Atatürk Airport numerous times, and we know that despite the security there, that they still are able to kill people there. But the most significant of all was the attack in Medina. This is the holiest shrine in Islam. And they're trying to kill people next to the tomb of Prophet Muhammad. This is defined sanity and everything that you know about ISIS. Nobody can understand why on earth they wanted to kill people there. And they lost, and I think it's turning public opinion against them. And let me remind you one last thing. The majority of victims of ISIS are Muslims.
That's exactly right. I'm so glad you made that point. And I'm also glad that you brought up Medina, because I want to ask, in attacking the burial place of Islam's Prophet Muhammad, have they overreached? I mean, if there was any waning or residual sympathy for them among Muslims around the world, have they now finally turned the needle against themselves?
I mean, it's not a popular movement for sure, but there is some people who are sympathetic with the plight for example, with the Iraqis in Syria, the Sunnis, and with the Syrians, because the whole world abandoned them at the death of half a million people. But saying that, the fact that they're killing innocent people, they're killing Muslims everywhere, they want to kill.
But and why to kill attack people Saudi in Arabia, Saudi Arabia, which is one of the most conservative Muslim countries in the world?
They have been, by the way, attacking Saudi Arabia for years. It's not just new. And they had three attacks, one in Qatif, which is a Shiite area, and they're trying to kill somebody close to the U.S. embassy in Jeddah, the consulate in Jeddah. And the worst of all was trying to reach people inside the Haram al-Sharif, where people were praying at the end of Ramadan next to the Prophet. I mean, can you imagine if there was a gun battle, they're trying killing people next to the Prophet's tomb? I mean, it's crazy. I mean, nobody can understand why they're trying to do that.
Christian, quickly, tell us what's different about the investigation into the attackers in Bangladesh. These were Muslim men, apparently inspired by ISIS, but from privileged backgrounds, which is not what we've seen in some of the other ISIS-related attacks. Although I remember that in 9/11, Muhammad Atta was a pretty privileged guy and apparently shopped in Target and ate at McDonald's or something.
Bin Laden,
of course.
Multimillionaire.
Yes, well, I know. I have to say I wasn't that surprised when that came out about the Bangladesh attackers, because one thing we've seen in this Islamic civil war with al-Qaeda and ISIS is that very often the attackers come from elite parts of society. They're not all desperate dead-enders by any means. They're very often educated doctors and lawyers. We need to get away from this idea that they're just depressed people who want to kill themselves.
All right. Well, we are going to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be going to your calls and your questions. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, a columnist with the Boston Globe, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And joining me this hour to talk about all this week's top international headlines, Christian Carl, senior fellow with the Legatum Institute and a contributing editor with Foreign Policy magazine, Nadia Bilbasi, Washington bureau chief of Al Arabiya, and Jeff Dyer, foreign policy correspondent with the Financial Times. So I want to go to the phones and bring in our listeners here. Ron in Waynescott, New York. You're on the line.
Good morning. Pleasure to be on the show.
Thanks for calling.
I have a speculative question for your panel. What do you anticipate would have happened had the United States not intervened in Afghanistan when the Soviets invaded and thereby creating the Mujahideen and set a lot of events into motion?
All right. Interesting question. It is hypothetical, but let's maybe go to Christian, since you have a book that begins in 1979, the year of that Soviet invasion.
Well, thank you very much for mentioning the book. I think it is important to remember that the Mujahideen, as the caller mentioned them, actually started fighting the Soviet-backed government in Afghanistan long before the Soviet invasion, long before the United States got involved in helping them. When Jimmy Carter made the decision to support the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, it was a covert program of support initially. They had already been fighting against the Soviet-backed government there, the communist government there. And certainly U.S. support and Pakistani support for the Mujahideen during the war helped them a lot. But we by no means created them or, were the only factor involved in their rise, that they were very much an indigenous force.
I actually always think about this. What we have seen in the whole Middle East and the greater Middle East, it goes back to three very important events. One was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. Second was, and the creation, of course, of the whole Islamic movement of some Arab countries who don't want people there. They said, okay, go to Afghanistan and fight against this godless occupation, which were the Russians, and led to the birth of Al-Qaeda indirectly. And second was the concept of the Iranian Revolution and the concept of exporting political Islam that led now to this deep...
The revolution that also happened in 1979,
exactly.
For that
matter. Exactly. It's the same date, actually. And it led to this sectarian strife and that we have seen now, to this tension between the Sunnis and the Shias. And the last was the American invasion of Iraq that became a magnet for Al-Qaeda and later on for ISIS. So all these big events has indirectly were a catalyst for what we have seen in all the violence and all... I mean, to a large extent, I think they can be responsible for what we have seen today.
All three of these major watershed events playing a role in midwifing the birth of Islamic extremism. Interesting, Nadia Bilbasi. Okay, let's go to a call from Jim in Kent, Ohio. Jim, you're on the air.
First, before I get to my question about NATO, I'd like to point out to your guests on the last comment that the Afghan revolution, the communist revolution, took place in April of 1978, and the Soviet invasion, as you called it, took place in at the end of 79. But it was in response to Jimmy Carter's policy to support these radicals to fight the new communist government in Afghanistan. So, I mean, and the Afghan government actually asked the Soviets to come in and help them against these Mujahideen.
Okay, well, we'll let Christian respond to that in a second, but go ahead. Did you have another question?
Okay, yeah. Well, Donald Trump said that he would disband NATO, and to me, I mean, I think most of what he said is nuts, and he's not credible in any kind of sense as a candidate or anything else, really. But to me, that's the one thing he said that makes sense for us to just get out of NATO, just abandon it, and because once the Warsaw Pact dissolved in 1989, the reason for NATO ceased to exist. Since that time, it went from being a defensive alliance to an offensive one.
All right. Well, thank you for your call. Let's first address if there's anything you want to say about the Afghan part of his comment, Christian, and then I'd like to go to Jeff on the NATO question.
Well, I'm not sure how deeply we want to get into the events of 1978 and 1979 Afghanistan.
Just a quick response.
But as the caller himself noted, the communist government took power there in the spring of 1978. And as soon as it took power, there was an uprising in large parts of the country, an indigenous uprising against very, very draconian communist reform plans that had nothing to do with the United States. So, again...
All right.
Fine.
Jeff, what about his comment that he thinks the U.S. should get out of NATO and that NATO is irrelevant, a comment that I think a lot of the leaders of the 28 nations gathered in Warsaw would thoroughly reject? Tell us, what's your reaction?
I think the way to think about this NATO summit is it's back to the future. I mean, ever since the end of the Cold War, NATO has had this identity crisis. It hasn't really understood what its function was. It did obviously go and take part in Afghanistan for 15 years, but it hasn't quite understood what its main core is now. But what this summit about is about reinforcing the basic NATO idea of territorial defense of our member states from the outside threat, from the east, from now Russia. Now, if you are an Estonian or Polish or Lithuanian, you absolutely today think that Russia is a direct threat to your security and could potentially has the capacity to invade your country. Now, what the caller is getting at, I think there is a legitimate argument to suggest that maybe some of the things the West has done in the last 20 years, the advance of NATO perhaps, trying to get Ukraine in the mid-2000s into NATO, maybe some of these things have stimulated this more aggressive Russian posture. But if you're in one of those Eastern NATO countries at the moment, you absolutely feel the Russian threat breathing down your neck, and you don't think that NATO is irrelevant by any shape or means.
All right. Nadia, let's talk a little bit about the political fallout from the Brexit vote. We now know that a woman is going to lead Britain for the first time since Margaret Thatcher, and it's between two of them. Tell us about the candidates.
There is a choice between two women.
Theresa May, the
Home Secretary. May and Andrea Leadsom. So it's really interesting because this is we will guarantee that we're going to have a woman prime minister in Britain after the exit of Margaret Thatcher in 1990. And actually, I was a student in England at the time. I remember the protests against Thatcher during these years. And it's interesting to see these two women who came by default.
Again, from the same Conservative Party. There
the
hasn't
same
been a woman
Conservative
leader,
Party. But this is a different establishment from what we used to see, which is the Eton, Oxford, male-dominated Conservative Party with the Tories parties. We have two women who came, different background. One of them is more known because she's a Home Secretary, and who is Theresa May. And the other one is not many people know her. Actually, I was talking to Jeff before we came here, and he said not many British people actually are aware of her because she's
a junior
minister who's about energy, etc. And she worked in the financial sector before, but. It's really interesting because Cameron miscalculated, obviously, as we discussed over the weeks about this referendum. And the fact that now the whole establishment, not just the Tories, but also the Labour Party, that as a result that even people are questioning the leadership of Corbyn. And
Jeremy
Corbyn was the Labour leader, and also talking about the two potential leaders for the Conservatives, which is Johnston and also another colourful character who was not in the Conservative, but in the Independent Party that also had to to exit Farage.
Nigel Farage. Not Farage.
So basically, you have these two women come into the scene. And I was one of the interesting articles that I read was that a quote by Oscar Wilde, who said, "You cannot believe that because of this exit or because of this leave movement, that you have a complete shakeup of the political establishment on every level. The head of the Independent Party is gone. The Prime Minister is going. The Chancellor of Exchequer will leave. The head of Labour Party is going to leave. And if you don't have, as Oscar Wilde said, you have to have a heart of stone not to laugh at this scene."
All right. Well, I don't know how many people in Britain are laughing over the effect that the Brexit vote has had on global markets. The pound at its lowest level in 31 years. Standard & Poor's stripping the country of its AAA credit rating. Goldman Sachs predicting a recession. Tell us, what's the latest on that front, Christian?
Well, the latest, I'm not sure if it's the absolute latest, but George Osborne, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, had to get together with the heads of a bunch of the big British banks and reaffirm their support for London as a global financial center, because now a lot of other European capitals and financial centers are trying to lure business away from London now that it looks like it will no longer be part of the European Union. Again, this is the sort of thing that, you know, if you'd told me that a month ago that this was going to happen, I would have said you were absolutely nuts.
I have to ask you, Jeff, these two women who we're talking about, both Tory party leaders, but Theresa May was against the Brexit vote and Andrea Leadsom was for it. So what kind of a difference do you think it would make? Does that affect who will be chosen, or does it affect how either one of them would carry out the actual exit, the negotiations with the EU to leave? Is it possible that Theresa May might say, you know what, guess what, psych, I didn't want to leave, and we're all reconsidering it, so it's not going to happen?
I think it's influence on both things. First of all, the election. The election now goes to the party membership. We are 150,000 members. It's not like in the US where you're a registered Republican or Democrat. This is the party activists. And they tend to be very anti the European Union, probably quite a majority of them in favor of Brexit. So though Theresa May is the favorite, she's the more established person. You know, she is a very important person within the cabinet, has been for 6 years. The fact that Andrea Leadsom was in favor of Brexit gives her an advantage in appealing to the members of the party. So even though she's not that well known, she still has a reasonable chance to come out of this as the leader. The second bit is how this plays out in how Britain approaches Brexit. And there are two kind of philosophies that people who support Brexit really come at it from. One is to say we want to cut down on immigration from the EU. That's the real driving force behind the UKIP party, the kind of more right-wing independence party. Also, a lot of Conservative members really wanted to cut down on immigration. But there's another school of thought that says it's an opportunity just to really have a much more free market philosophy, to have this bonfire of regulations. We'll kind of keep a good trading relationship with the EU, but we'll be more free to just tear up regulations and reduce taxes and have a much more Thatcherite-type economic model. Andrea Leadsom is probably going to be more leaning towards the immigration issue if she becomes the leader. Theresa May will be less worried about immigration and more worried about trying to have a more competitive, low-tax, free-market British economy.
I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Nadia, tell us about this Chilcot report, this 2.6 million word exhaustive report conducted by Sir John Chilcot over the UK's involvement in the Iraq War.
Well, this is an independent report. As you said, it took almost 9 years in the making. What's interesting about it, it reinstated what everybody knows about it, that basically the reasons for war was relying on flawed intelligence, that the fact that Iraq did not pose any security threat to the United States or to Europe, the fact that Saddam Hussein has no link to al-Qaeda per se. All of this and the diplomatic channels were not exhausted enough before they went to war. But what's interesting, I think, is this little personal memo that Tony Blair, the Prime Minister at the time, wrote to President Bush. And he said to him, "I will be with you no matter what." Even going against the advice of his senior advisors and assistants. And some say even he lied, and he said he changed that memo. And the fact that he wholeheartedly committed to a war, that everybody thought that the United States and the neocon that surrounded President Bush was determined to have, no matter what. And they already have the case, and they're trying to find the evidence afterwards. Tony Blair, I think, lost credibility. I don't know if you heard him in the press conference. He was talking about it hasn't been a day that he has not been reliving this. And what's ironic about it, and I found it a bit really astonishing, that the fact that he said, and this is why I spent all my time in the Middle East. I mean, he was the most failed head of a representative of the quartet, as if he did something amazing to save the Middle East. Tony Blair is a very controversial character. People said he's very obsessed with people with money and power. And despite the fact that he introduced himself as a new Bill Clinton in British politics at the time, modernizing the Labour Party. But unfortunately, I think this is going to be sticking with him, despite the fact there was no new evidence, but I think it put Tony Blair on the spot.
Well, one legacy of this, no doubt, is I think British politicians are going to be very careful about writing any memos or emails saying that they're with the U.S. or anyone else unconditionally. All right, let me read an email from Carol in Cary, North Carolina, who says, ISIS uses Western indifference to Muslims as a recruiting tool. Isn't it in our best interest to take better care of refugees from Syria to counteract ISIS's propaganda? If we want the Middle East to turn against radicalism, why don't we treat refugees better? Christian.
Well, I think the caller absolutely has a point. I think one of the big problems in all of this has been the lack of a coherent policy on refugees and migrants and immigration in general throughout the West. That maybe we need to start seeing this as not just a domestic political and economic issue, but also as a security issue to a certain degree.
All right. Well, let me take a last call from Doug in Naperville, Illinois. Doug, you're on the air.
Thank you, and good morning, Indira and panel.
Good
Be
morning.
Grateful if you could please discuss the life and witness of Elie Wiesel.
Well,
thank you.
That is a wonderful question to take us out of our hour on a somber but also uplifting note. Elie Wiesel, of course, the Holocaust survivor who died this past week. Who would like to reflect on his legacy? Nadia.
Well, I mean, definitely he was an icon of the anti-Nazism, and he stood up for rights, or human rights, wherever it exists, in Rwanda, in Kosovo, elsewhere. He was the moral voice of what happened to one of the worst tragedies in human history, which is the Holocaust. President Obama said he was a moral voice, probably the strongest moral voice that we have heard, and everybody's going to miss him. I have one criticism, though, that he never spoke against the rights of the Palestinians.
And it's
in support of the rights of the Palestinians that he was somehow supportive of Prime Minister Netanyahu. He's supportive of the settlement movement. The worst violator of human rights is occupation, and the Palestinians have been under occupation for more than 40 years.
Christian, your take on Elie Wiesel.
Yeah, I think he was, in fact, a monumental figure. It's a horrible cliche now when we talk about giving voice to the voiceless, but I've spoken to friends who are the children of Holocaust survivors who told me that their parents could never really talk about the stuff that happened to them. And he came along and he enabled people to become open about these things in a way they never were before. And I think it's largely due to him that people can discuss this issue as openly as we can today.
And, of course, the whole never forget movement of the Holocaust. It's striking, as you say, Holocaust survivors are dying out. He was, of course, in our 80s. You make the point about it being hard for Holocaust survivors to talk about their experiences. I'm actually the daughter of a concentration camp survivor from Poland, and I have to agree with you that Elie Wiesel showed great leadership, and for many people who lived through that horrible experience, was a real light in getting them to talk about their feelings, share those, and, of course, make sure that it never happens again. Well, thank you so much to all of you for helping us wrap up a very difficult week in the news. Christian Karl, senior fellow with the Legatum Institute, contributing editor with Foreign Policy, Nadia Bilbasi, Washington bureau chief of Al Arabiya, and Jeff Dyer, foreign policy correspondent with the Financial Times. Thank you all so much for joining us. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, a columnist with the Boston Globe, sitting in for Diane Rehm, and thanks to all of you out there for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Alexandra Boti, Susan Casey, Danielle Knight, and Allison Brody. The engineer is Alex Drewenskis. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and podcasts. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.